This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Are America and Iran on a path to war? Iran is launching missiles. Donald Trump is tweeting threats and starting sanctions. Iran is threatening to attack Israel. How serious is this going to get? We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about how dangerous Iran is becoming and how serious the danger is that this will actually escalate into war. President Trump's first day in office, he pulled America out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. This was quite a blow to Australia and New Zealand in particular, both close allies of the U.S. The Australian Prime Minister went so far as to say maybe they'd have to offer America's vacated place at the table to China. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer and Aussie Callum Wood and Asia analyst Jeremiah Jacques about how the Trump administration's approach to trade could actually help China fulfill its economic goals. A destructive riot at the University of California, Berkeley last week in protest over a scheduled lecture. This is just the latest sign of the violence dividing America and besmirching our political life. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about this trend toward lawlessness and where this is leading. And I'll conclude the program by giving you some pretty simple advice about the last thing you do at night that will really make your day. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. What will Donald Trump do about Iran? This is a pretty important question that's going to be tested to its limits in the time ahead. You can be sure we've seen some serious back and forth happening between America and Iran since President Trump was inaugurated, not even 3 weeks ago, and it's certain to escalate. To talk about this, we have via Skype our man in Jerusalem, who's actually currently visiting our office in the UK, Brent Noctegal. Hello, Brent.
Hello. Hello.
So take us through this sequence of events here. It started with Iran test firing ballistic missiles last week.
Right. So we even, I think, discussed this a little bit on the Trumpet Hour last on the Week in Review program, and just showed how Iran was kind of testing the United States underneath the leadership of Mr. Trump to see what they would do if they tested ballistic missiles. They had done this a number of times under President Obama or during while he was in charge of America, and yet he did nothing because one of his goals was to increase the relationship, enhance the relationship with Iran, and kind of turn over a new leaf. Well, a new president comes in, and Mr. Trump comes in, and the Iranians let these ballistic missiles go as a test to see if Donald Trump was going to be just to see what he would do in reaction. And what he said was that he put Iran on notice. He had a tweet saying as much, and his one of his secretaries gave a statement saying that Iran was on notice for these actions. That was last week. And then on Friday, the Trump administration did sanction 25 individuals and companies that were connected to Iran's ballistic missile program, including the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps as well, some members of that, which is really just a kind of a little slap on the wrist. I don't think it's really going to change Iran's actions. And even the Iranians said as much, these sanctions weren't going to hurt them. And then coming into this week, we had a number of retaliatory comments from the Iranians towards the President Trump. Even today, there was quite a barrage coming out from Iran's leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. He talked about saying, quote, from Tuesday, he said, Trump says, fear me. No, the Iranian nation will respond to your comments with a demonstration on the 10th of February. So that's just a couple of days away. But he's saying that in a couple of days, we're going to respond to your comments. They will show others what kind of stance the nation of Iran takes when threatened. So threat comes from the United States. Threat is returned across the net from Iran back to the United States.
And that's where we are as of right now. The Trump administration says Iran is on notice. They slapped down a little bit of sanctions. Iran says we're not going to stand for this. We also have, you posted an article just a couple of days ago saying that Iranian leaders warned of serious consequences if it were attacked. The title of your article, Iran Threatens Missiles on Israel If America Attacks. Tell us about this and how seriously should the United States take this?
Well, this comment didn't come directly from the president or the Ayatollah, but it did come from somebody high up in the military establishment saying that it would take about 7 minutes for a missile to reach Tel Aviv from Iran's territory. And it said that if the United States strikes Iran militarily, that's what they'll do. They'll take out their anger on the Israelis. Now, these ballistic missiles that they're testing are the ones that will eventually reach into Israel.
Okay, so they do have the capability. I mean, Israel has to be paying very close attention to all of this, and this, in a sense, is really testing the resolve of America's commitment to Israel and the relationship between America and Israel. It seems like Iran is deliberately trying to put a wedge there, or at least see just how deep the Trump administration's loyalties to Israel lie.
That's possible, definitely, but I don't think that Mr. Trump or the Israelis would be upset. Well, would think that Iran would follow through with that threat in this current climate. Their end goal, for sure, is the annihilation of Israel, Iran's. But whether they would try and do that right now, while Trump is being kind of threatening towards them, and they don't know if he will act militarily towards them. So I think that would be a pretty big risk for Iran to actually carry through with that. And as from the Israeli standpoint, they are happy that an American president looks to be standing up to Iran finally. They will, whether that puts them in the firing line or not, they'd be happy that Mr. Trump is doing this.
This is obviously something that could change at a moment's notice, but you're viewing the statement from this Iranian military leader as basically bluster.
Yeah, I think it is. While it does reveal their end goal, I think the Iranians are still testing the waters. We'll see. We'll see what happens on February 10th. I don't think it's going to be an Iranian missile striking Israel, though.
Let's talk about this article that Sam Livingston wrote. The title of his article, Iran is More Powerful Than Ever. This is up on thetrumpet.com. Our listeners can view it there. But he's quoting the Washington Post here. It says the U.S. faces an Iran that is now more powerful than at any point since the creation of the Islamic Republic nearly 40 years ago. What is it that makes Iran today such a formidable foe?
This article, I think, was perfectly timed because it revealed something that we have been talking about for a number of years, that Iran was on the march across the Middle East, that they would lead a Middle Eastern alliance that would threaten Europe and threaten the United States. And that's what we're seeing today. And it points to a number of qualities of the Iranian regime right now, characteristics. Number one being the ability it has to project its power across the Middle East through its proxies, be it in Syria, Lebanon, Yemen. We see everywhere there's a hotspot right now. It is Iran that's being the adversarial character that's dictating terms to the other Middle Eastern nations. They're doing that, and they can mobilize those forces. They've proven themselves absolutely loyal to the Iranian regime, so they can destabilize the Middle East further if they so desire. It also talks about the sanction relief that they received as a benefit of the nuclear deal, $100 billion that was unfrozen, at least $100 billion that was unfrozen for them to use. It talks about how OPEC, the recent decision by OPEC to cut output, didn't affect Iran, so they're right now, their economy is doing quite well. Geopolitical Futures had an article about that this week, that the Iranian economy is growing. The people might not be experiencing the growth because the money is being channeled and funneled to where the Ayatollah believes it's being funneled to, but that's another reason. It also talks about how the Americans right now are involved with Iran as an ally in so many fights across the Middle East because of the fight against the Islamic State. This is what we've talked about for a number of years, actually, on this show. If you look at Iraq and if you look at Syria, if President Trump wants to fulfill his promise at eradicating the Islamic State, he's got two options. Send your own troops in there or use the troops that have been fighting for you, really, fighting for themselves, but with you against the Islamic State. And that's the Shiite militias in Iraq. That's Hezbollah and the Syrian regime inside Syria. If you want to fight against the Islamic State, you actually need Iran to be on side. And that puts them in a very powerful position, as this author noted.
So this article basically says if Donald Trump wants to reverse this trend, he is really going to have to get neck deep into this, and he's going to encounter some pretty serious obstacles. You're mentioning the fact that the Islamic State is a factor in here, and it's actually putting America and Iran on the same side in that one arena. What are some of the other obstacles that America would face if he did really want to make good on this threat?
Well, I think you would face an American population that doesn't have the stomach for wars in the Middle East. And that's a big issue that needs to be factored in. He does ride on the popularity of the American populace, and he has received that. And part of that was because he said he was going to be tough with Iran. But when it comes to war and sending your own sons off to war, America has seen a lot of that. And he also got in there into office because he promised that America would not have this endless type of foreign engagement and putting their men on the battlefields of other countries, that defending other countries that didn't really uphold American values or even give America back anything in return. So I think that's probably a big thing that he's going to face if he chooses to follow through with military action.
It seems like the implication in this Washington Post article as well is that there was maybe an underestimation, a miscalculation of the extent of Iran's activities in the Middle East, that it's a bigger problem than what he's making it out to be.
I think that's definitely possible. Most of his election victory was due to what he was seeing inside America internally, and while foreign policy is something that's important, it wasn't a feature on the debates a lot of the time, because that wasn't what he put the focus on. Trump guided the narrative for the election, and a lot of that was what's happening in America, and he might have overlooked a lot of what's going on, how far Iran is reached through the Middle East. But I don't think his support, the people that he's put in charge of making a lot of the military decisions are unaware. There have been a number of his advisors that have talked about even not cutting away from the nuclear deal at this point, because that would destabilize the Middle East so much more, because Iran can do so much to hurt the United States and to turn the Middle East on fire even more if it wants to. And they're so unstable, the leadership in Iran, as the Americans would view it, that's very possible. So maybe there was an underestimation from his point.
It is. Maybe what we could do is just look at what we know from Bible prophecy, and this is maybe a couple of steps down the road, but the outcome, what we expect to see, America is basically sidelined. Iran has definitely cemented its control over the Middle East. The Bible refers to it as the King of the South, that it has rallied the forces of radical Islam to its cause and provokes a war with Europe. So knowing the outcome, as we try to trace back what happens and we look at the current situation where you see what appears to be Iran and America and particularly the Trump administration on somewhat of a collision course, it's difficult to see Donald Trump kind of easing his way out of this in a way that doesn't undermine this persona and this sense that he's projected of his being someone that can't be bullied and someone who's not going to give in without a fight. There's an interesting confluence of factors here that seem to suggest at some point here, America is going to end up being humiliated or shoved aside somehow.
somehow, yeah. I do feel that there is a way to de-escalate this. I hate to use that word because that's what's thrown around all the time about de-escalating this situation, this crisis that's developing. And there's even been a number of commentators that have come out and saying Trump has been too verbose and too outlandish in his threats to Iran because they can't back down, and now he can't back down. Right. So this is heading towards war. But you know, Iran has even, I think today, they've granted the United States visas to the wrestling team to visit Tehran. They at first protested this with a Muslim ban back last week ago and said, nope, Americans aren't flying in here. They've got a good faith measure towards the United States. So we'll see if there's a little back and forth this way. I think Bible prophecy, though, does indicate that America fades from the scene and in a way isn't able to project its power internationally because of potentially internal problems that do develop within the nation. And that's something that we need to consider. It looks like America's flying high right now, but you don't know whether Mr. Trump's attention will be diverted from Iran because he has greater problems in America's home soil. I can also see, at least in the near term, the president work with another Middle Eastern power now, Russia, to counter Iran in a way that's kind of behind the scene, at least in some arenas, be that in Syria, and even maybe in Libya, we'll see. But there are other actions that he can take short of military strikes in Iran that could hurt Iran, and that could also help Bible prophecy. So short term, I think we see a cozying up of Trump to Russia that might actually come out and hurt Iran. But we don't foresee military action from the United States and Iran. That doesn't look to really follow Bible prophecy.
Nothing that would hamper
right.
Iran's
nothing that'll
rise.
Change the situation.
Yeah,
Iran's is not at the peak of its rise yet.
Right,
the United States is not going to stop that just yet.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about tensions between the Trump administration and Iran. We have a couple of articles online about this subject, one from Sam Livingston, the other from Brent. You can find those at thetrumpet.com. The one is called Iran is More Powerful Than Ever. The other is about Iran's threatening to strike Israel if America retaliates against Iran directly. Find those at thetrumpet.com. A very interesting situation to watch, and I guess we'll keep our eyes peeled on what happens February 10th. Thanks for your time,
we'll be
Brent.
Watching. No problem.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
It's been really fascinating watching just how rapidly things are changing around the world as a result of Donald Trump taking office as America's president. Leaders in capitals of other countries are trying to figure out how Mr. Trump changes these national relationships. And in Australia, this question became really important when on the first day in office, President Trump canceled the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. This is an economic bloc of Asian nations that was to include America. It was a blow to Australia and New Zealand, very close American allies who were part of the TPP. They're trying to decide how to handle this rather than just throw the deal away, a deal that they still view as important. I have trumpet writer Callum Wood via Skype from Australia. Hello, Callum.
Hello, sir. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, and joining us here in the studio, I also have our Asia analyst, Jeremiah Jacques. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hi there. Great to be with you.
So President Trump did have some legitimate reasons for disliking the TPP. Maybe, Callum, you can just start by giving us a summary of what this deal was about and the pros and cons to inking it.
Not a problem. Well, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, was an incredibly large and complex deal that's been forged over the course of a few years now and negotiated between a lot of nations around the Pacific, a lot of the smaller Asian nations, Australia, New Zealand, and of course America's in there as well. And this deal was designed to solidify the economic bonds between these nations. And in a way, it was designed to prevent China's economic rise in the region, or at least slow it, hedge it about. China wasn't in the TPP, or it isn't at the moment, And there was a big reason for this. The other nations in the TPP, Australia, these smaller Asian nations, by joining the TPP, they were signing on to say that if they want to trade with other nations, they're either going to be taxed or fined or have higher tariffs in some way, shape, or form. And so it's going to be more costly to trade with nations outside of that bloc. And so you can see why Donald Trump wouldn't like that as much. It obviously limits his options in some ways. He wants to have trade relations with individual nations, free trade agreements, like he does with Australia and many other nations around the world, and have more options, because we know certainly that Donald Trump is thinking America first in a lot of ways.
Australia and New Zealand, the way that they reacted when Donald Trump said we're scrapping this deal, the way they're viewing it, this really hurts them.
For Australia and New Zealand, this was actually touted as a really good deal. Now, Australia, New Zealand, a lot of these smaller Asian nations, this is a great opportunity for them to trade with America, with each other, in a way that perhaps would produce more economically, especially for nations like Australia, which do have a lot of exports to these Asian nations. We have a lot of raw minerals and raw materials that these Asian nations want. And to be in the Trans-Pacific Partnership was a great opportunity to give out these materials and whatnot to these nations under this trade agreement. And certainly it obviously brings benefits other than economic. It draws us closer politically in some ways as well, being in such a partnership. And so Australia and New Zealand was actually quite a blow to them, especially to the political parties. The average everyday Australian or Kiwi might not necessarily feel the immediate ramifications of not being in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but certainly the government is feeling it straight away. We can see the reactions from Malcolm Turnbull and from the New Zealand Prime Minister as well. Both of these men just scrambling to save face personally. I mean,
they'd really invested a lot of their own political capital in the passage of TPP.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is a deal that's been worked out over the course of a few years and under numerous prime ministers in Australia. And so for Malcolm Turnbull to be the one on whose watch this TPP has collapsed would be a black mark against his term as leadership. And certainly you know that in Australia, leaders can come and go quickly, certainly depending on just one or two mistakes here or there, it seems. We went through about five prime ministers in 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, I'm so having trouble keeping up with them.
Really change.
Yeah. So in this last time, as soon as Donald Trump announced that, the big news was that Australia's Prime Minister Turnbull, he said that this was a big loss, there's no question, but we're not about to walk away. Certainly there's potential for China to join the TPP. And you mentioned, Callum, that this was actually a big part of the intent behind the design of the TPP was to try to hedge China's economic dominance of Asia. And now here the Australian Prime Minister is saying, well, let's prop the door open for maybe China to enter. It wasn't like a formal invitation, but in your view, Jeremiah, how likely is this to happen, or how does this resonate in Beijing?
Well, I think that it is possible that China could join the TPP, but in my view, it's quite unlikely. And that's because, as we discussed, the entire thing was designed in large part to contain China, to sort of in a way present an alternative to these smaller nations in Asia and in around Australia, to have the U.S. to do sort of streamlined commerce with on a really expanded scale. And all of that was intentionally designed to exclude China. And so to suddenly say, okay, well, the U.S. is out, so China, would you like to just jump on in? You know, I just feel like because of the sort of thin-skinned, easily offended nature of the Chinese, that it would be a little bit unlikely unless there were heavy revisions in the TPP. It would have to undergo a new round of negotiations, specifically addressing labor legislation and intellectual property, both of which were designed in what the Chinese view as a very pro-American kind of a fashion. So they would want to heavily revise both of those. But also there's the fact that China, at the same time as the U.S. had been constructing the TPP with these other nations, China had been concomitantly building its own alternatives to that, including the RCEP. That's the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. It's part of the ASEAN framework. And then there's also the APEC pact, both of which are in many ways kind of a corollary to the TPP. So in my view, while it is possible that we could see China say, wow, this architecture is already set up, we'll just jump in and take the place of the U.S. and be the lead player in the TPP, it's possible, but I feel like instead we'll see them invest more effort, more capital, more time into developing these alternatives.
Well, the New Zealand government actually said that it would consider switching from the TPP to the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, this Chinese-run initiative. It tells you just how volatile the situation is and how much, I guess, the dismantling of the TPP, however you may look at whether or not China would enter into it, there's no question that this does increase China's bargaining power and their clout within the region. And these other nations are immediately looking at China as being a replacement, in a sense, for the influence that America would exercise there. Wouldn't you say, Callum?
Absolutely. And like Jeremiah said there, it actually, I think it would serve China's interests more to see this TPP collapse, because it does have these other options. It does already have the RCEP, and it's got its Asian Infrastructure Bank to compete against the World Bank. And it has all these China alternatives to these American economic developments. And so to see the TPP collapse would actually strengthen China's case in drawing these other smaller Asian nations in there. These nations, they're looking at Donald Trump and they're seeing the political turmoil. They're wondering what he's going to do next. And then you could look to China alternately and say, well, look, their leadership's not changing. It's quite sturdy, and they have these other options, and they are available to us. They can see China growing both militarily and economically. It's becoming a more viable alternative. Whether or not Australia and New Zealand end up moving into some of those, that RCEP or not, is debatable. Certainly, Prime Minister Bill English and Mr. Malcolm Turnbull, when they made these comments about going back to Asia, it might have just been an effort to try and sway Donald Trump, saying, "Hey, look, we're going to go back to China," and hope that it might change Donald Trump's mind. But it really hasn't. Certainly at the moment, it seems like his thinking is America first. And if that means, severing some economic ties and perhaps undermining the alliance a little bit with his friends in New Zealand and Australia, then so be it. But certainly for China, this is a great opportunity for growth. If the TPP collapses, then all of a sudden the Asian alternatives look a lot more promising to the other nations in the region.
It's hard to say at this point. Obviously, this is all happening very quickly. This is all just developed in the last couple of weeks. But it does kind of raise the question, how much of a strategic blunder, or at least strategically nearsighted, was this in terms of the Trump administration's calculus, trying to manage Asian affairs and economic affairs, and knowing that China has as much power as it has? I just wonder, is this a matter of kind of looking at things a little bit too short term as a business transaction and trying to make sure that the bottom line works out, versus recognizing some of these more pressing geopolitical realities? What's your view, Jeremiah?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I believe that from a strictly business standpoint, just looking at the bottom line, maybe it was wise to pull out of the TPP for Trump. But if you consider the geostrategic secondary purpose of the organization, then it just begins to appear a little bit short-sighted. Like, sure, we may have boosted America's short-term economic gains, I guess you could say, from this, but we've also really unleashed China in a way that I believe over the next few years, I believe analysts and Mr. Trump himself may regret that.
It does bring to mind what happened at the Davos Economic Forum just recently, where China, they showed up for the first time. They presented themselves as something of a replacement for America as the guardian of the international order. I wonder, Callum, how eager other nations would be to see China play that kind of a role. I mean, they're certainly presenting themselves like that, but it seems like there would be quite a few nations who would hesitate to just jump ship from, say, an American-centric global economy to a Chinese-centric.
Yes, that's right. But you made that reference there to jumping ship. And if the ship you're on is sinking fast, then the whatever the alternative might be, it's going to look more and more appealing as the ship goes down, you might say. I mean, America's really abandoning a lot of allies, and like Jeremiah mentioned again, you know, this was a good move for Donald Trump economically, but perhaps geopolitically, he didn't consider the ramifications and the message that he's sending right now to these smaller Asian nations, some of which don't want to see China on the rise. That you've got many nations in the region, even from Japan to Taiwan, perhaps even the Philippines in some ways, that don't want to see China dominating the region, and they want to have America's influence in there, and there have the American economy as their viable option instead of going to China for resources, for trade, for economic development. But if America's pulling out, and certainly if we see America struggling in other areas, then the Chinese option is the only option left. A lot of these nations, they need somebody. They need someone that they can rely on for their trade. A larger nation, certainly leaving Australia, New Zealand, they need trade with these larger nations. And right now it's America, but if America keeps pulling out, if the trend continues, then China is the only option available in the region.
Certainly interesting to just see how much events are kind of leaning China's way, and their ascent has been fairly impressive over the last couple of decades, and in recent years in particular. As much as Donald Trump talks about trying to pose some kind of a counter to that, it does seem like to this point things are looking pretty good for China, and China's growth is something that we've tracked quite a lot in its prophetic significance. Biblical prophecy talks about just how central China is going to be to end time events in Asia, and the fact that it's going to be one of two pillar nations in that continent, in that region, that will lead an alliance of nations in a battle that will really involve the whole world very soon. You can read more about that in our free booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy. We've been talking with trumpet writer Callum Wood and trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about Donald Trump canceling the TPP or pulling America out of it. And Callum has written an article that appears on thetrumpet.com called Australia Switching Sides from the U.S. to China. Look for that online at thetrumpet.com. We sure appreciate your time, Callum. It's an early morning for you, but we do appreciate you, your willingness to share your insights with us.
Always a pleasure.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
1 week ago, the campus of the University of California, Berkeley, was ablaze as protesters became violent. They lit a generator on fire that produced massive building-high flames. They beat people up. They smashed windows. What were they so upset about? Well, they wanted to block a right-wing speaker from giving a public address. So much for freedom of speech in America. This is where we are in this country today. If you say things the left doesn't like, you're going to get violent riots. It's quite a picture of how divided America has become and how lawless. To talk about this, I have trumpet writer Andrew Miller. Hello, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about this incident in Berkeley, first of all. Who was it these Berkeley students were protesting, and why do they hate this guy so much they're willing to destroy their campus to express that hatred?
Yeah, well, this was Breitbart news editor Milo Yiannopoulos, who was coming to the University of California, Berkeley, to give a speech. And Breitbart News has been labeled the so-called alt-right for some of its views against illegal immigration into America and other issues. And so these students, apparently several thousand students, were upset that someone who works for an organization that talks about supports temporarily banning immigrants from high-risk terrorist countries from coming into America or for enforcing American immigration laws was coming to their campus. So they had, like I said, several thousand come out and protesting. And of course, all the major media sources were talking about this being a peaceful protest, at least at first, until a little bit into the evening, like 150 people wearing just like black masks and carrying like pipes and clubs came in and started, like I said, yeah, smashing windows, and they'd gotten a generator, like a gasoline generator, and set it on fire.
So do we know where these 150 black-clad protesters came from?
I haven't actually seen much so they can figure out exactly who they were, because they were masked, and there was only one of them that actually ended up getting arrested. The university tried to blame these masked protesters as like outsiders. Although, as for our write up on the Trumpet website that our writer Kieran Underwood did, he mentioned that even though it was even these 150 people who came in halfway through the protest who did most of the violence, the other 1,000 people were cheering and yelling their approval all throughout the burning and the smashing and the looting.
Right. He described it as a symbiotic relationship between the crowd and the more violent of the protesters. So it does seem like there's a general spirit of encouraging that kind of violent behavior. When you see a mob and you see somebody who, you know, actually takes the step of smashing a window or doing something, there's just a lot of times where you have a lot of people standing around that are voicing their approval for what they see.
Right. And the banners from the protest, the banners said things like "this is war" or "become ungovernable." So
right.
the banners were very much in the vein of violent protest.
Ungovernable and peaceful, they don't seem like they can quite be used in the same sentence.
No, not synonyms at all. And I think it was from the National Review, David French had likened these 150 people who showed up to like the SEAL Team 6 of the leftist rioters, to where, you know, obviously SEAL Team 6 goes in and kills Osama bin Laden. And most people in America are very supportive of their decision to do that. And so there's, like I said, you've got these 150 people in masks who are doing the burning and the rioting, but it's the other several thousand people that are who initiated the protest and created the environment for them to come and do this and cheered their support for them throughout the entire evening.
This, what we see is they're talking about this like this is a revolution. You hear language being employed more and more, the language of revolution. And so much of that, and well, so many revolutions of the past have been very violent, but it really is a spirit of destruction as much as it is anything else.
Right. Well, if you're going to kind of have a revolution, if you want to implement a new system, you've got to tear the old system down first. And that's, you do especially see that in the college campuses, because, I mean, they've had this one that they're they're upset against the Trump administration and they're upset against this Breitbart News editor. So they're saying this is war and we need to become ungovernable. But you saw similar things. We've reported on this program before, and like the riots or protests at the University of Missouri, where people are chanting, like, all we have to lose is our chains, which is an exact quote from the Communist Manifesto. Or I just saw a report this morning about a group at the University of Central Florida called the Knights of Socialism that were holding like their own fight club. The banner for the fight club said anyone can come except Republicans. And they said it was basically training on how to beat up fascists. That being the Knights of Socialism's code word for Republicans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also saw an incident up in New York that was reported on. This was at the NYU. There was a group of students from NYU who were protesting there was a group of Republicans up there and a professor from NYU came out and began berating the police, just screaming profanities at the police for not beating up the Republicans. She was calling them, she was saying, you know, you're here to protect these students and they're not going to beat anybody up. You're supposed to do that. Your job is to beat up these. She was calling them fascists and neo-Nazis and saying that these people who were staging a peaceful expression of what they were, you know, their views. She said, your job as police is to beat them up and shut them up. So, you know, nothing says anti-fascism like demanding that the state attack your political opponents.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of like the thing in Berkeley. They're like, we're for free speech unless the person speaking is from Breitbart, in which case feel free to burn everything down. Or up in New York, like I said, and we're against police brutality as long as it's police brutality against minorities. But if it's police brutality against Republicans, that's your job.
Right. So this is a really dangerous moment that we're in the United States. So we drew attention, I think Stephen Fleury drew attention to a statement from Frank Luntz. He's a commentator for, I believe it's CBS, where he was talking about the country. He said, you know, we're kind of back to where we were at Berkeley in the 1960s, and the country is unraveling. You know, he said we have 1968 all over again. And this is something that we've talked quite a bit about because of specific prophecies describing just how dangerous and deadly the conditions within the cities in the United States are going to become. Gerald Fleury has written about that. He wrote an article called America's Coming Civil War. It's something that every listener, every reader, anyone who's following these events really needs to understand just how dangerous this is going to get. And you can really see it building to that point. It seems like every time these protests erupt again, that there's just a little bit more, they're a little more violent, a little more destructive than they were the time before.
Yeah, and becoming more frequent. It's been, like I said, yeah, a lot of ways, you're right there. It's almost back to like the level it was at the 60s. I don't actually remember any presidential campaign like that within my lifetime where you've seen this type of physical violence like we've seen in the lead up to this presidential election. And now that President Trump's won, it looks like that same type of protest and violence has continued right on, almost as like a permanent fixture in American society. And as like I said, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has pointed out in that article and others, this is something that was prophesied in the Bible thousands of years ago that will get much worse, specifically talking about like in the first chapter of Isaiah, talking about your cities are burned with fire. Strangers devour them in your midst.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's interesting too, just how if you look at history, how it's been those who have the more politically liberal view, and you can see it certainly in the communist system, and so many others that have agitated for a revolution, that they are the ones who are most willing to use fascist type techniques and strong arm tactics in order to bring the population to heel. Like they are the ones who are, they're accusing the Trump administration, they're accusing the government of fascism. It's the more conservatives they call fascists, and yet it's the more liberal political view that tends to embrace those tactics the quickest.
Right. Well, when you get a political revolution, normally the party that wins is the party that's the most ideologically devoted to the concept of big government. It's like, I mean, they've got that joke about the libertarian plot to take over the government and leave everybody alone. But it's so it's, but if you're so if you get like whatever party is the most devoted towards using the power of the state towards implementing its agenda, oftentimes comes out on top in an anarchical situation like this. It's why revolutions normally come in two waves, whether you're talking about the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia or the Iranian Revolution in Iran, or even many of the Arab Spring revolutions, as you get the first wave, which is mostly a bunch of like young college students who really don't know what the world they're talking about. And they're just angry and they're protesting and they're trying to take down the system. Now, once the system's been taken down, you'll get like a smaller cadre of well-organized government officials that will come in and hijack the movement of the revolution and implement their new regime.
Yeah. Yeah, we've seen that play out time and time again in history. And in this case, just looking at it through the lens of Bible prophecy, it's not going to result in a new regime until there's just been a whole lot of death and destruction within America's cities in particular. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the violent lawlessness that we see rising in America today. We have an article on thetrumpet.com called UC Berkeley Riots Are a Picture of Divided America. It's by Kieran Underwood. Go to thetrumpet.com and read that. And I would also encourage you to read Gerald Fleury's article, America's Coming Civil War. It's linked to within Kieran's article. But it really does point to some prophecies that every one of us needs to be reminded of and watch for as we see these things unfolding before our eyes. Well, thanks for the conversation, Andrew. Enjoyed it.
All right. Always a pleasure.
It's time for today's last word.
Good news! Scientists have found a gene that enables those who have it to perform extremely well on 6 hours of sleep a night. Bad news is it's found in less than 3% of people. For the other 97% of us, 6 hours isn't nearly enough. Do you get enough sleep? Most people don't. Research says the average adult needs 7 to 9 hours a night. Teens need 8.5 to 10. Yet 3 in 7 Americans aged 13 to 64 say that on weeknights they rarely or never get a good night's sleep. In related news, Americans drink on average 3 12-ounce caffeinated beverages every weekday. The quality of your sleep significantly affects the quality of your life. Evidence overwhelmingly shows that proper sleep makes you mentally sharper, increases your concentration, improves your emotional balance and creativity, enhances your physical performance, makes you a more productive worker, and even helps prevent you from gaining weight. Nothing else delivers quite the benefits that adequate sleep does. While you sleep, your brain is amazingly busy. It's performing biological maintenance. It's keeping your mind and body running in top condition and preparing you for the day ahead. But it all hinges on one predominant factor: going to bed on time. Far too many of us just don't do that. some people pride themselves on being able to perform well on less sleep. Well, it turns out many of us can, sporadically. The Society of Neuroscience found that a sleep-deprived person can actually deliver similar results to a well-rested person, but he can't sustain it, and for a very specific reason. We all lose focus at times, but brains that are sleep-deprived are unable to refocus as quickly as well-rested brains. A sleep-deprived person experiences near-normal brain function, interspersed with brownouts in attention and severe drops in visual processing. It's like your body is compensating for lack of sleep by taking micro-naps. Researchers have found that for every lost hour of uninterrupted sleep, workers spend 12 more minutes per hour cyber-loafing, using company time to check personal emails and so on. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimate that 40.6 million American workers, 30% of the civilian workforce, doesn't get enough rest. Harvard scientists estimated in 2011 that sleep deprivation costs U.S. companies $63.2 billion in lost productivity per year, mainly because of presenteeism as opposed to absenteeism. People showing up but turning in subpar work. What exacerbates this effect is that sleep-deprived people don't notice their decrease in performance. They function normally enough that they have a false sense of their own competency. Research at Harvard and Berkeley has also revealed an amazing side effect of pulling an all-nighter. Short-term euphoria. A sleepless night increases your body's dopamine levels. This chemical surge may briefly boost motivation and positivity, but it encourages ill-founded optimism, addiction, and impulsive behavior because the regions of your brain that are responsible for planning and evaluating decisions just shut down. The pathway where dopamine travels is called the mesolimbic pathway. Some research indicates that frequently overstimulating this pathway by sleep deprivation can permanently hamper your brain's neuroplasticity, its ability to adapt to new situations. Among college students, for example, 4 years of repeated sleep deprivation can have serious long-term consequences, including neurological degeneration. So here's the take-home lesson. It's simple, but fiendishly difficult. Go to bed when you know you should. God designed us to require a certain amount of sleep. Have you ever thought about that? Have you ever thought about why? God never sleeps, it says in Isaiah 40 and verse 28, but we require several hours of unconsciousness. Surely God had several reasons for creating us this way. Maybe he used it to keep us humble, to remind us that while human, we are limited. It's certainly also a means of developing character, making choices to use our waking hours wisely and to exercise discipline in our bedtime. Some people think they can catch up on lost sleep over the weekend. Not true. In fact, according to the book Chronotherapy, sleeping late on Saturdays only lets your sleep clock drift later, making it even harder to wake up on Monday. So what do? Few of us have the option of sleeping in indefinitely. Our real choice comes several hours before that at bedtime. So obey this law of health and go to bed on time. Your quality of life depends on it. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send your thoughts on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests today, Brent Noctegal, Callum Wood, Jeremiah Jacques, and Andrew Miller. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from Oscar Wilde: the smallest act of kindness is worth more than the grandest intention. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.